Hello, I'm Manila Chan. You are tuned in to Modus Operandi. If you haven't already heard, Ukraine isn't the only hotspot in Europe these days. Serbia is back in the news, but this time, not for being home to the world's best tennis player. But the Serbs are serving up some hot language at Kosovo. The volley of violence over the past year has some concerned that this could be a throwback to 1999. We'll explain. All right, let's get into the MO. A little less than half the world recognizes its independence. The world literally split on what to call it. Some global key players like Russia and China don't recognize its sovereignty. But the United States and most of the European Union say Kosovo is independent as of 2008. The West's favorite line of rules-based order condemned the tit-for-tat sparring between Serbia and their smaller neighbor, Kosovo, even when the smaller neighbor seems to agitate the former. Take, for example, the issue of license plates. When Kosovo was carved out of the former Yugoslavia after the turn of the millennium, many ethnic Serbs still lived in the newly divided territory. And the Kosovo government said Serbian-registered cars must also register in Kosovo and then swap out plates anytime they enter the territory. Now, that could get frustrating, right? Think of it like this. While most people who work here in Washington, D.C. actually live in Virginia, you would have to pull over each time you were about to enter the district, unscrew your license plate on your car, and put on the D.C. one before you can drive into work each morning. That's a nuisance, right? But to make it worse, what if the district said this is only applicable to certain races of people? Nobody would stand for that, I imagine. But that's precisely what's happening at the Serbian-Kosovar border, and that's just the trivial parts. It gets a lot hairier than that. To explain all the heavier stuff, we're going to bring in our in-studio guest, Nebojša Malić. He is a Serbian-American writer, historian, and analyst. He wrote a regular column for antiwar.com for nearly 20 years. You look so young. He's now a senior writer for RT.com. Neb, so good to see you again, live and in person.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So, Neb, first, can you give us an update as to the latest happenings between Serbia and Kosovo after, you know, several violent spates and clashes between the two sides since last fall of 2022?
So the latest round of unpleasantness really began last August, mm-hmm. End of July, when the ethnic Albanian prime minister of Kosovo, which I refer to as a breakaway Serbian province, Albin Kurti, decided that those license plates had to go. And he's invoking a 2013 agreement with Serbia regulating traffic across the boundary line, which was signed by now president of Serbia, Aleksandar Vučić. The problem is that Kurti's government hasn't implemented any of the provisions of that agreement themselves. And so they're insisting on selective enforcement of things that, in their interpretation, bolster their statehood and independence. And they're going after things that are, you know, validating rule of law as they see it. Meanwhile, they're refusing to carry out any of the obligations they took on themselves, such as guaranteeing political autonomy to the actual ethnic Serbs who live there. And things just got worse from there. Because after the U.S. specifically, and most of the EU, because there's still five members that don't recognize Kosovo as an independent state, ironically, including Spain, which is where the current EU foreign policy commissioner is from, they pressured Kurti into backing down. And then he went ahead and started doing other things. And if it's not one thing, it's the other. Getting to the point where the Serbs who were actually participating in Kosovo government institutions decided to step away and boycott them as illegitimate, as a sign of protest. At which point they were promptly replaced in sham elections that had like single-digit turnout of local ethnic Albanians. And things just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And you had the rhetoric from the U.S. and the EU, basically Kosovo's Western protectors, condemning all sides and urging everybody to exercise restraint, but not actually doing anything to get Kurti to stop.
Right.
And he, on the other hand, kept saying, well, we're a sovereign country, we do whatever we want, and we just want to apply the law on every inch of our territory. And, you know, fast forward almost a year, things have gotten so bad that, you know, you've got the Serbian military on high alert, you've got Kurti sending heavily armed special police to drag people off the street, and, you know, he's making lists of prominent Serbs to sort of decapitate the local community and accuse them of sham war crimes in a conscious effort to basically destroy this community and get them removed. And nobody's doing anything. The U.S. and the EU are threatening sanctions, and I'm using air quotes because their sanctions amount to a hill of beans. They're literally not enforcing their own rules in their own so-called rules-based order. And I've been on the record for years and years and years before that phrase was even put together, condemning Kosovo as an example of how Western rules don't work.
Right, right. So the Serbian president, Aleksandar Vučić, he has used some very strong language about what the Kosovar government is doing to the minority Serbs there. Things like, words like pogrom, ethnic cleansing. You know, these are trigger words usually in the West. But what evidence has he provided to back such claims? I mean, are those choice of words really a fair characterization of what's actually happening on the ground?
Considering that last summer, when at the height of the license plate business, the Kosovo authorities literally went to a family winery, a Serb family winery. It's been a family in the family for generations. And they insisted on confiscating all of their wine for alleged non-payment of tax and brought in several tanker trucks to pour the wine into and destroy it. And basically decided to move ahead with that, even though people offered to pay whatever fine was they were supposed to pay, just don't destroy our wine, please.
Right.
No, they moved ahead and destroyed the wine to make a point. That's just one example of what's been going on there. You've had people kidnapped from their workplaces. A guy who was working at a car wash, you know, half a dozen cops, full battle dress, long barrel rifles.
Like riot gear.
We're talking like SWAT team.
Wow.
Converge on him from seven directions to arrest him at
one
a car
guy.
Wash. One guy, shirtless, working the car wash. For he didn't do anything, but they said, oh well, he planned a war crime of insurrection against the Republic of Kosovo or whatever the hell they came up with. They arrest people for wearing T-shirts. They've for the first time in years, the Serbian church had to move the site of their annual commemoration of this 1389 battle against the Ottoman Turks from the actual site to a monastery nearby because their security couldn't be guaranteed. These are tiny little moves that add up to a death of a thousand cuts. They're not yet rampaging across the province like they did in 2004, but they got away with that. And the lesson of 2004 in the minds of ethnic Albanians, specifically Kurti, is that if they can do this, they can get away with it.
So are these people getting disappeared, or what's happening to them?
You've got prominent community, not even community leaders, just prominent people in the community getting disappeared or arrested on bogus charges. You know, they drum up a war crimes charge from 20 years ago, and they find three witnesses who swear that, you know, this person personally did something, and there's nobody to corroborate it, but they don't care. That's enough to throw them in jail, beat them up, you know, hold them indefinitely. And they do this systematically to basically decapitate the local community, to the point where the locals are actually making a joke because Vučić had said something like, you know, you'll be hunted like rabbits, and they started calling themselves the rabbits, as opposed to, you know, the resistance. But they are definitely not showing signs of, you know, stopping resistance. They're basically saying, this is our home. We're staying here. We don't care how much they're terrorizing us, but please do pay attention to the fact that we're being terrorized.
Right. So, you know, some of the latest tensions stem from, as you alluded to earlier, those elections in Kosovo where the Serbian population, effectively all, every single one of them, boycotted. They didn't turn up to the polls in April. Tell us what happened there to prompt, you know, a whole population of people to boycott elections.
So there are pockets of Serbian Serbs living throughout the province who stayed there after the mass ethnic cleansing of 1999 when NATO occupied it and turned it over to the ethnic Albanians. The largest contiguous population lives in the north, in several of the counties up there, and they had their own local municipal officials. And then these people resigned in protest over Kurti's abuses last fall with the license plate business and other things like sending special police to terrorize people. And then Kurti decided to use this and call a new election in which he ran ethnic Albanian officials who would, you know, get like 5 votes or, you know, 1% turnout.
That's all it takes to win?
He would carpetbag people in and they would get votes of local ethnic Albanians because maybe a dozen Serbs altogether participated in this charade. And he said, oh, these are legitimate, you know, municipal officials now, and they're taking their, you know, oaths of office in Albanian. They're taking down Serbian flags and putting up Albanian ones and so on and so on. And when the local Serbs protested at the end of May, Kurti called in his special forces. Mm. And when those special forces got too scared, he called in NATO peacekeepers.
Right.
And then those NATO peacekeepers opened fire on the ethnic Serbs who were protesting.
That's how you keep peace.
Because that's how you keep peace.
Yeah.
And then, to the shock and surprise of everybody, those local Serbs fought back. Okay. And there's this iconic image of a local man who took the riot baton from one of the
peacekeepers,
and he's beating the peacekeeper with it as he's trying to trample one of his buddies
baton.
On the ground. Yeah. He's turning the peace baton back on the peacekeepers.
Yes.
And basically, these people resisted. And then, of course, Kurti's order went out to find everybody responsible and arrest them for terrorism. So it's just this endless spiral. So instead of setting up the Association of Serb Municipalities, which he's been supposed to do since 2013, he's basically said, well, there's no Serb municipality, so there's no problem.
Right.
He's literally trying to erase these people.
But real quickly, now, I mean, Albin Kurti seems to be now tacitly agreeing to EU intervention or assistance. I mean, it's sort of like an election do-over. Is that going to be enough?
No. What he's trying to do is the EU gave him, as much as the EU can be straight about anything, they gave him, here's what you're supposed to do, instructions. Or else, and the or else was left vague, you know, or else we'll stop giving you as much money. That's that sort of thing. You know, their sanctions are...
Sure.
We won't support you 110%, only 99%. Well, and he came up with a counterproposal, and the counterproposal is, I do whatever I want. And I'm going to organize a new election, but only if these people petition me on the official letterhead of my government and recognize and bend the knee to my will. I'm translating, obviously, but this is what it means, in effect. And so far, that's where things stand, because obviously the point is not to have a municipal official with a Serb name. The point is to have a municipal official that has not bent the knee to Kurti's government.
I see.
Because everything he's been doing has been in a function of not necessarily making anything function, but to break the local Serbs and make them bend the knee to his government, make them
my way or the
publicly
highway.
Announce that he's the legitimate ruler, and
gotcha.
And you know, get recognition from Serbia, international recognition, because he doesn't have that, and he wants it because everything he does, you know, the whole thing of in the 2000s after the NATO occupation, the whole, well, all of these problems that we have in society, you know, from falling birth rates to economic collapse to people moving away, everything was blamed on lack of independence. Independence will fix it, independence will fix it, independence will fix everything. Well, they declare independence in 2008, and it doesn't fix anything.
Right.
And things keep getting worse and keep getting
worse.
And
here we are.
And now, well, but here's the thing, then they just shifted. Well, it's not lack of independence, it's lack of Serb recognition. So now they're pushing, this is a universal excuse. Now, the problem is that this is the cradle of Serbian statehood. It's not just a piece of territory. If it was just a piece of territory, that would be bad enough. But it's got multiple levels of meaning for the Serbian people as a whole. Never mind the government. Never mind the Republic of Serbia, the state that exists.
Hold that thought, because I want to dig into this piece of real estate on the other side of this break. All right, coming up next, is Serbia gearing up for war with its neighbor? We'll discuss it when we return. More with Nebojša Malić. Sit tight, the MO will be right back.
Hold up. counter the Russian state control narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez, monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays. On est en France, quoi, c'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly, all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
In Dagestan, one of the most ethnically and culturally diverse regions on the entire planet.
As you make your way through Dagestan, you will discover each region is known for its own unique arts and traditions.
I'll look forward to talking to you all.
That technology should work for people.
A robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law.
Show your identification.
We should be very careful about artificial intelligence.
The point, obviously, is to create trust rather than fear.
I would like to take on various jobs.
I mean, with artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon.
A robot must protect its own existence, its own existence.
Welcome back to The MO. I'm Manila Chan. Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić seems to be at his wit's end on how to handle what he's described as a belligerent neighbor and is calling on the UN Security Council now to weigh in. So back with us to discuss is Serbian-American journalist Nebojša Malić. So, Neb, while President Vučić says he's ready to work with the EU to de-escalate, he also said this. Take a listen.
Serbia is not preparing for war, but is ready to protect the lives of our people. Serbia is ready to protect its country from all those who would potentially want to jeopardize its integrity, sovereignty, and the lives of our people and our citizens.
All right, Neb, so we didn't play the lead up to that, but Vučić made it a point to say that Belgrade has fulfilled all of the requests from the EU, but Vučić implied that his Kosovar counterparts have not. But now troops are on high alert. Given what happened to Serbia with NATO bombings in the late 90s, isn't it kind of fair to argue that the Serbian government is, you know, worried it could happen again?
Partly. I think Vučić is keenly aware of the present situation in Europe being sort of in a wider context. I think what he's saying, and I think he's correct about this, that the Kosovo situation is being exploited both by Kurti and the West, each to the for their own ends, as a way to pressure Serbia to fall in line over the Ukraine question. Because Serbia hasn't imposed sanctions on Russia. It's trying to stay neutral.
Right.
He cannot align politically with NATO and stay in power. No president of Serbia can.
Right.
There's 80%, 85% public opposition to this. You cannot govern in the face of those numbers if you try to run this policy. Problem is that the EU and the US and NATO really want him to, and they're trying to pressure him using Kosovo as a way to break his will there. And break Belgrade. They've been using Kosovo as a cudgel for years. And Vučić has formulated it this way. He basically says, why are you demanding of us to recognize, to give up our territorial integrity and sovereignty in the name of protecting Ukraine's? It makes no sense. This is not just hypocrisy. This is just nonsense. We support Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity, but at the very least, we demand that you respect ours.
Right.
And that hasn't happened. And so he's been sort of bouncing this ball back into their faces. Now, Kurti's not making it easier. I think he's sort of off the reservation, and I'm very deliberately using this turn of phrase, because he's actually been ousted once before by the Americans a couple of years ago when he tried to do things that they didn't necessarily approve of.
Right.
Essentially, a good ruler of Kosovo is the one who does whatever the American ambassador says. This is what independence we're talking about, right? It's actually a bit, pretty humiliating position for ethnic Albanians as well. And I think Kurti actually, what he wants to do and what he's pledged to do and what he's been trying to do is get some sort of de facto and even de jure union with Albania. And I think he was hardest hit when the Albanian president, Prime Minister Rama, said, well, you know, as long as you're doing this anti-NATO behavior, I'm not going to hold a joint meeting of our governments. I'm going to back away. I can't, you know, collaborate with you if you're going to anger my NATO masters. But that didn't stop him from organizing this NATO love fest the other day of, you know, trotting out all of these kids named Bill Clinton or Hillary or whatever to honor Bill Clinton's visit.
Yes.
And basically, you know, do some pretty pathetic things an independent country wouldn't really stoop down to doing in order to honor.
Not ordinarily. Well, hang on to that thought of Bill Clinton, because I'd like for you to take us back to Serbia in the late 1990s. Bill Clinton was president of the United States back then. He told the media here that, you know, the Serbs are carrying out ethnic cleansing of Albanians. The media here ate that up. They propagated those narratives happily. NATO jumped in, bombed what was then Yugoslavia, even striking the Chinese consulate there, killing Chinese nationals. You lived through those events. How has that shaped the situation that we're seeing now?
Well, that's by and large determined where we're at now. The fact that they intervened in Kosovo based on the lie of genocide that was never substantiated. It later emerged that all of these tall tales were essentially fabrications by intelligence officials. They could never be substantiated. The total number of deaths was something like 2,000. They keep talking about 10,000, but that's a ballpark estimate that they never substantiated. NATO literally started a completely illegal war of aggression based on a lie. And that we saw that repeated a few years later in Iraq. Perpetuated later in Afghanistan. And now we're having a situation in Ukraine. And as a matter of fact, the Ukraine situation, I would argue, is a direct consequence of what happened in 1999, because NATO went from what was supposed to be a defensive alliance to an unmistakably aggressive one.
Yeah.
That sent a very clear message to Russia that the West can't be trusted. You actually had Boris Yeltsin's government fall. He resigned at the end of that year and Putin became president. Multiple people have said it, this is not just me making this up, that the Kosovo War had a lot to do with that. And so this is sort of the root of, this is where, if you're into alternate history, this is the branch off. This is the inflection point. This is where things
go. A
fork in the road. This is where things go in a certain direction. And, you know, the Chinese embassy bombing, that was, the Chinese have never forgiven and never forgotten.
Sure.
It was officially the only mission that the CIA itself planned. They sent some blood money to the Chinese, but the Chinese government just recently memorialized it in a very unmistakably, we're still mad about this way.
Sure.
So that sort of, defined relationships with China for years. And you essentially, you know, some years ago, I was trying to tongue-in-cheek make a suggestion to the Trump administration that the way to disarm Russia on this whole Ukraine issue was to unrecognize Kosovo and get rid of that precedent, because, you know, it was Trump. He could do crazy things and get away with that.
Sure.
Because he's, you know, so unusual. And just unrecognized Kosovo, sort of press the reset button. Sure, everybody's going to shriek, but they're going to shriek anyway, and they did.
Right.
But you're essentially removing the biggest argument from the table.
Right.
You're taking that off the board.
Right.
And of course,
you address the elephant.
Right. And nobody took my advice because, you know, inertia is a powerful drug, more powerful than cocaine, apparently. And you know, they went ahead and kept doing what they were doing, and then, you know, they ended up with some sort of trade deal that nobody ended up caring for, and the only beneficiary ended up being Israel. But I stand by that. He could have actually defused that situation by unrecognizing Kosovo, because that would have essentially domino affected all the way to Ukraine, and maybe made the Minsk agreements work. Wow. But it's one of those what could have been, because we'll never know.
Right. Well, so from those ashes, we know, obviously, Kosovo was officially carved out, you know, this tiny nation created just instantly, just like that. Now, for all the news surrounding that area, you and I were talking about this before the break, you would think that this is some vitally important piece of real estate to the West, that it had oil or it had cobalt or something like that, and that the entire world recognized its sovereignty. Mm. But that's just simply not the case.
There is mineral wealth there, but that's not why it's important. It's important because for the West, for the U.S., for NATO, it's a sets a precedent that they can create countries, that they can bomb whoever they want, whenever they want, wherever they want, and make exceptions to the rule. Sovereign is he who decides the exception.
Kind of just like a look what I can do.
Right. To the ethnic Albanians, it's important because it forms the nexus of this greater Albania that they've been trying to set up since the 1870s, even though they have a nation state as of 1913. For the Serbs, it is not the real estate. It is, I mean, obviously it is the real estate because it's part of the constitution and you don't give up a part of your territory. But this is the territory that they essentially reestablished their statehood to regain.
Oh, I see.
It's being when they say
part
this
of
is
the
our
premise of
right.
It.
This is our Jerusalem. This is this is you know, when Serbs say this is our Jerusalem, they mean this is the holiest of holies. This is the place that we need to retake as a resurrection of our statehood. Without it, we don't exist. No matter what territory we hold. With it, no matter if we have no territory, we can continue. It's a spiritual issue.
It's a you complete me.
It is not just a territorial dispute, even though I don't want to minimize the territorial dispute in question. But so it's multiple things to multiple people. And unfortunately, with the Western involvement, it's one of those, well, look here, look what we can do. You know, creating the rules in the rules-based order that doesn't actually function.
Last thing, Neb, we're running out of time, but looking at U.S. foreign policy, Taiwan, for example, the U.S. says it abides by the one China policy, while at the same time, you know, selling lethal arms to Taiwan, convoluted mixed messages from Biden, then direct contradiction from Blinken. Is Kosovo comparable to the Taiwan situation?
Well, insofar as you can use the way the U.S. is behaving with regard to Kosovo to understand that none of these words matter, none of these treaties matter, nothing you hear from the State Department or the White House actually matters. At the end of the day, you have to look at what they're doing and not what they're saying.
Right. Absolutely. I got to leave it right there, unfortunately. Naboisha Malich, geopolitical analyst, senior writer at RT.com. Thank you so much for sharing your insight and some of your personal story with us. That is going to do it for today's episode of Modus Operandi, the show that digs deep into foreign policy and current affairs. I'm your host, Manila Chan. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you again next time to figure out the MO.